Welcome to A Fork in Time, the alternate history podcast.
Welcome back to A Fork in Time, the alternate history podcast, and we've got the two-seater, what have we termed it?
I think we've decided to term it the What If Machine, because we're concerned that,
copyright issues.
If it's not copyright issues, at least it's infringement indirectly on Josh and Chuck at Stuff You Should Know if we called the Wayback Machine, but I actually think they're infringing upon, like, a cartoon when I was a kid where Professor Peabody or somebody had a Wayback Machine, so we're probably safe doing that, but I think it's better if we just call it our What If Machine.
What If Machine, and as you just heard, Dawn's in the car with me. But I'm going to be taking the lead on this one because, surprise, surprise, guess where we're going?
To Japan.
I mean, that'd be a little bit of a shock.
Yeah. we're not going to Far Asia.
No.
Oh, okay. Then I guess we're probably going to that bejeweled isle known as
England
or Britain.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yes.
So, where are we headed today, Lex?
So, we're going to head back, and before we were starting to record this podcast, it reminded me of the little teaser we did talking about the themes in history and the survey we did, because we're headed back a little bit earlier than we have in the past, but you're going to see it's going to connect to some stuff that we've talked about on the podcast before. But we're headed back to about the early 1400s, with the little figure Henry V.
Henry V. So, I like to call him Henry V.
One of the podcasts I listen to calls him Henry Mach 5.
Henry Mach 5, that works for me. Sadly now, for those of you of my generation, I suddenly have this picture of Speed Racer on the English throne, so I'm going to have to work around that. For now, apparently the entire recording. Thanks, Lex. But I'll make it through that, as long as there's no Spritel and Chim Chim underneath the threat. Yeah. Anyway, we won't even go there. Sometimes you don't even want to know the associative nature of Don's mind. Believe me, you don't want to know the associative nature of Don's mind. Actually, before we get started with the podcast proper, I talked about this in the episode where I sort of brought back and explained some of the results of our theme survey. And so this is probably a good chance. You and I haven't had a chance to talk about that together on the podcast, and I know, Alexis, from the conversations we've had off podcast, we both agreed that there are these big themes.
Yep.
And certainly they're the big themes when we're talking about a period of European history. One of those big themes, and we're going to get into that big theme again today, so let's talk about the big theme a little bit, and then we'll go down to the end of the what if, taking things in a little bit of a backwards. I guess we'll do an inductive version of A Fork in Time today. One of the major themes in European history from, really, I guess, post the Norman Conquest in 1066, all the way down for a really long time, is the relationship between what we, in a modern sense, and even then, called England and
France.
And just to, you know, I know most of our listeners are obviously sophisticated and understand this connection as well, but the real issue is, when we talk about the Norman invasion, and we start talking then about the kings of England, and we're talking really about folks who were French nobility, right?
Essentially, yes.
And so you have this situation where they still have interest and concerns back on the continent proper, and this consistently rises and falls over the course of several hundred years of history.
Correct. And also, going alongside that, kind of running concurrently, and it's going to come up in the podcast today, is not only do we have kings of England who have French ancestry, you also are far enough removed from 1066 at this point that you have kings of England marrying back into the French nobility and the French royal line. So you have that double line of French influence and Frenchness coming into play.
Right. And then the other element that goes with that, of course, is the idea that the geographic proximity of England and France meant that part of the motivation for many of those marriages was to keep the was to keep the peace in some way, shape, form, or fashion, right?
Correct. I mean, they are so close together that you can actually swim from one to the other, yeah. So...
People have done it. Interestingly enough, it's called the English Channel and not the the French Channel, but that's a whole other... That's a whole other thing to talk about. So again, as you might have guessed, we're going to be talking about a historical what-if that does relate to this sort of big theme. I wanted to point out that we know it's a big theme. We know it's a theme that we touch on frequently, but the reason we touch on it frequently is that it is such a dominant theme for Europe, for at least that part of European history, as we go through Western European history, for a long period of time. And so I just wanted to get that. That's the elephant that's sitting over in the corner of the room. It's neither pink with polka dots, so we'll leave that alone. The other thing, for those of you that know, we've recently brought on our regular contributor, Chris Coppola. A lot of reasons for bringing Chris on. We have enjoyed getting to know Chris and meeting Chris through the podcast, but also Chris has much more of an understanding of Eastern European history, which is not plagued by the England-France problem.
No.
And so one of the benefits that you'll have in 2021... moving forward, I guess technically this will be an episode in early 2021. We're recording in late 2020, but you'll see us be able, even when we're talking about European history, to much more move into the 19th century, but in the 20th century, but also dealing with the eastern part of Europe equally well as we deal with the western part of Europe. So again, what is going to be our point of departure today, Lex?
So, we're going to be talking about what, and we're going to get into this, but what if Henry V had lived a little bit longer than he did in the real timeline.
Okay, so our focus today is going to be on the historical what-if of a Henry V, or Henry Mach 5, if he had lived a bit longer. So we'll pick that back up after the break, and we hope that you stick with us.
Hi there, guys. This is Alexis and...
Don.
Taking a little break from the podcast to tell you about one of our favorite things, and that is what, Dad?
That's Audible. And
does Audible do?
Audible does everything. At least it does everything when it comes to playing audio programming for you. So that's, I typically think of it as being audio books, but it's not just books. It can be periodicals, magazines, theatrical productions, podcasts even now. Just anything that you can imagine that is audio can come through Audible.
Absolutely, absolutely. We, of course, love, we are avid readers, both Dawn and myself. So, but we like to be lazy sometimes with our reading. We like to be read too. So that's where Audible comes in. And if you're like us and you like reading, but maybe want to try being read too for a change, we have a little deal for you to check out Audible. What's that deal?
The deal is an opportunity for you to get a 1 month free subscription to Audible, which comes with one credit. A credit is how you purchase, again, an audio book, an audio program, whatever the case might be. And so if you follow either the link that's in our show notes or go to www.audibletrial.com/aforkintime, you'll be connected there. You can see how to sign up. And again, you'll get that 1 month at no charge, a chance to try it, see if you like it. And you'll also get one credit, which will go towards, again, an audio purchase. That could be a book, fiction, nonfiction, whatever it might be. And I guess the other thing to mention, Lex, is what happens if you also happen to be an Amazon Prime member?
That means you actually get two credits. And as we get into the holiday season, I'm sure a lot of people are taking advantage of Amazon Prime. So take advantage of this, too. If you're an Amazon Prime member, you actually get two credits with this deal instead of one. So maybe two books.
Yeah, two books. Or that way you can check out different variety. You may choose a fiction and a nonfiction genre, for example, to see how you like that. One of the things I know that Alexis and I often talk about is sometimes a great reader can actually make a good book even
better.
Even better. And a lot of the productions now, the audiobooks and other audio programs, are done by excellent readers. And I know for me, I can think of some of my favorites. Don't want to belabor them here, but sometimes they can bring a whole new life into something you may have even already read before by hearing it spoken.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
All right. So we encourage you to take advantage of that offer. Again, that's a link in the show notes on our website, or go to www.audibletrial.com/aforkintime. Thanks. Welcome back to A Fork in Time, the Alternate History Podcast. Don and Alexis with you today, taking another historical what-if trip. That's what we do here on this podcast. That's sort of what it's all about. And so today we're going to look at a point of departure, or as we like to call it, the fork.
Mm-hmm.
And that fork is going to be around a Henry V that survives longer and the implications of what that means. So what do we always sort of have to cover first?
That'd be the what did.
Yeah, before we can talk about the what if. So briefly, Lex, what is the historical what did of Henry V?
Henry V. So we're talking about Henry V today. So quick kind of snapshot of his life. He's actually born in 1386. He becomes king in 1413 upon the death of his father, which is Henry IV. We got a string of Henrys right now. But he becomes king in 1413, and quite quickly after becoming king in 1415, he decides to go to war with France. That lasts for a few years, ultimately ending up in 1420. Henry V signs the Treaty of Troyes, and in that treaty, Charles VI, who is the King of France, recognizes Henry V as his heir, so Henry V will become King of France upon the death of Charles VI. Charles VI also gives his daughter Catherine in marriage to Henry. They get married in 1420 when that treaty is signed. The problem is, 2 years later, 1422, Henry V dies.
Okay, so let me try to understand this, and this is that period of history where I know enough about it to be dangerous, but not enough about it to always follow the details. And as we were talking off podcast, there's lots of Henrys. You run into multiple Edwards. It seems like every time you turn the corner in English history, there's a foreign Catherine.
Yeah.
Somewhere around. So,
or five at one time.
Yeah. So was the ultimate thinking in this treaty that essentially they would become one nation? Was that really that, or is that a naive view of what was actually going on there?
I sort of think of it, and this is probably not the greatest comparison or analogy. I'm sure if we have British listeners, they're probably once I said this, be like, no, it wasn't that at all. But I almost have it in my head, almost like when Scotland and England were ruled by the same monarch, but technically still two separate countries. It's almost like that. It's like, we're over both, but they're still separate. They still have their own somewhat unique identities. It's just they happen to have the same ruler, same monarch currently. So I don't see, especially with geography, there is a body of water, although it's quite narrow, but there is a body of water that does separate England and France. So I don't see them kind of becoming this one nation. It just kind of happens to be that there's two nations with the same ruler.
Okay. So again, and you know, it's tough to know because we don't see how it's actually going to turn out.
Right.
But we do know that for much of this period, as we've already talked about, there are English claims to continental lands because of historical, again, going back, the fact that they were Normans. It's the Norman conquest from Normandy, which is on the continent in modern-day France, is the reason for that. So, you know, part of it is just understanding there. Now, Henry is famously known, really, for his skill, his general. Part of the reason he's in this position is he's very successful. The English army under Henry is very successful militarily, right?
Yes, the most famous battle he is involved with is the Battle of Agincourt, which is also in 1415, at the beginning of this war with France. Very, very famous battle.
And so part of the thinking is that if you have Henry living, he is capable enough as a military leader to hold on to what he's gained and perhaps do other things if he has the stronger base, in theory, of both England and France.
Correct, yeah.
To be there, and that's what would have happened. So, again, the thing that throws a monkey wrench into the whole situation is that he comes along and he
dies.
And he dies. So how does he die?
So he dies, again, in 1422. So it's a couple years after marrying and becoming the heir to the King of France. And he dies of dysentery.
Okay, so
it's very sudden. It's not an injury from a battle. It's not. It's just a disease that he dies of in August of 1422.
Okay. Does he die with or without an heir?
He does have an heir. The problem is that heir is very, very young.
How young?
Less than a year.
Less than a year. So as we often run into in a lot of situations when we look at history and monarchy, we run into this situation of a regency situation.
Correct.
And normally, at least from my take on that, there tends to be a theme about regencies. I don't think I've ever read about a regency that just went really...
swimmingly?
Yeah.
It went great. There was no problems.
Yeah. The truth of the matter is, if there is such a regency, the reason that you probably don't hear about them is, well, because nothing happened. But it does seem to be that normally when there's a situation here, it's really candidly one of two things. It tends to be the regent wanting to hold on to the power that they're supposed to temporarily wield on behalf of the person for which they are the regent.
Right.
Or the fact that you have an opportunity that suddenly opens because you have an infant or a child or, you know, be a boy or girl, king or queen. You have somebody who's not of the age of majority yet to assume the throne in their own right. This opens up the door for somebody else who has designs upon it. So those designs might be the regent themselves, or it might be somebody else.
Right. And a thing that happens with regencies a lot, in fact, we're actually going to get into this family a little bit later in the podcast, but I have a line from the Tudors in my head where, again, we're dealing with a regency, and it's like whoever controls the monarch, if it's a regency, controls the throne. So especially when you have a regency where there might be multiple people that are qualified to hold that regency, you have this infighting of they have it, and then it gets ousted from them, and that it's not very stable. Just to back up a little bit, I looked up when Henry VI, which is Henry V's son, is actually born. He's born December of 1421 and becomes king in August of 1422. So very young king on the throne.
Yeah. He's when you're less than a year old, you're not exactly going to be able to wield power in your own right.
Correct.
Across an entire kingdom, or across multiple kingdoms, again, separated by a body of water, you're probably not even able to wield your own authority inside of your own crib, hardly at that point.
Right.
So, who is named his... We'll get off the historical what did, obviously, here, and move into the historical what if pretty soon. But who is named... Who is regent? How is Henry VI, at least in theory, ruling things here?
So, he's got a few uncles that are kind of ruling for him currently.
So, again, with a regency situation, someone is ruling in his stead. So, let's pivot off of the historical what did to get into the what if.
Okay.
So, 9-month-old Henry VI will eventually succeed to the throne, correct?
Eventually, yes.
Okay. And what will be his ultimate disposition?
He, unfortunately, inherits a little bit of mental instability from his mother's side. I mentioned his mother is Catherine of Valois. Her father is Charles VI of France, and Charles VI of France has a moniker, Charles the Mad.
Okay, so part of the issue, well, we'll even go down the whole, you know, intermarriage among cousins, among cousins, among cousins, the very nature of, you know, brings hemophilia and madness. Apparently this is the two things that it sort of most produces. So we have a situation where even once he becomes of age, his ability to actually rule, his ability to actually carry forth the task is limited, correct?
Correct. He is very shy, he's very pious, but also he's got this background of mental instability that doesn't lend itself to a very strong-bodied king.
Okay, so ultimately, again, still chasing the what did a little bit here. We are going to get to the what if. I know we're 15 minutes in. We are going to get to a what if. We've got to really set up the what did, though, to get to the what if. Ultimately, because of that instability and because of the flow of events after that, what do we end up getting into?
We ultimately get into War of the Roses.
Okay. And the War of the Roses, of course, is an extended multi-generational civil war that flares hot and cold at various points between the vying houses for the English throne.
Correct.
And the ultimate end of it's the battle between the Plantagenets
and the Yorks.
But ultimately, and there's York monarchs and there's Plantagenet monarchs, but ultimately there are no York and Plantagenet monarchs, because what do we end up with?
Tudor.
We end up with Tudor monarchs. And so the resolution of the War of the Roses is the rise of the House of
Tudor.
Mm-hmm. And the House of Tudor is important, obviously, because it brings us
some big figures in English history.
And literally a big figure in the case of one of them, Henry VIII. And we've talked about that. We don't need to go down that path. Everybody's well familiar with that. So the real historical what if with Henry V,
mm-hmm.
Henry Mach 5,
yes.
living longer is, what's the primary presupposition that you have of him living longer? What's the biggest change potentially in history?
Well, biggest change is we don't have a minority coming to the throne upon his death. And another subsequent big change is because, I mean, they'd only been married for 2 years. They got married in 1420, he dies in 1422, so they only have the one child. He keeps living, they can have multiple children, so it's possible that the person we know as Henry VI doesn't even become king, because does he die in 1423 and then not have to become king? And then we've got this other person that becomes king instead. So those, I think, are the biggest things. A, you don't have a minority with Henry VI because you have Henry V living long enough to get past that. And also, again, this is completely untested. We have no idea because of what actually happened and the what did. But do you have the person we know as Henry VI dying? And so you don't even have the person we know as Henry VI sitting on the throne.
Okay. So the argument is that you have this, obviously, the extended reign of Henry V,
mm-hmm.
and how that might influence both England and France because
Correct.
Of the connection that's there, the marriage that's taken place. But most importantly, you don't. His untimely early death leads to the regency, and the regency and then ultimately the mental instability leads to a whole series of events that dominates for a couple of hundred years.
Right.
So if you avoid that, again, you go through this period of time in English history where you don't have, in theory, this internal conflict called the War of the Roses. And we've talked about this, I think, multiple times. Again, this is this big theme coming back again. If you don't have the internal conflict inside of England, what does that enable them to do
externally?
And then you also have the question of, if you don't have this conflict, what does that do in terms of, obviously, who eventually succeeds to the throne?
Right.
I mean, we've talked about this so many times through a number of different ways that we've managed to get there, is that, you know, we did this in one of our early episodes, which was about what if Arthur, Henry VIII's older brother, had actually lived. You get no Henry VIII.
Right.
This is going back multiple generations to get to no Henry VIII. And, you know, the reason we keep focusing around Henry VIII is also tied to one of the other big themes that we've so often hit on the podcast, which is the Reformation. And again, the understanding here that the English Reformation is of a slightly different flavor in many ways than the Continental Reformation. Henry's Reformation is not Luther's Reformation.
No.
You know, it can be argued that Henry would have never led off in the area of any form of Reformation if it had not been for the need to dispose of
Life number one.
Although there certainly were Reformation forces inside of England that would have eventually made this an issue.
Right.
It was going to be an issue no matter what.
But it wasn't going to come from the top.
Right, and it wasn't going to come down with essentially, you know, in fact, just recently been studying this and actually dealing with this in a teaching environment, is the fact that, you know, the Act of Supremacy, which I think is 1534, if
yes.
my memory serves, the Act of Supremacy did one thing. It simply said that
I'm the head of the Church of England.
Correct. And for the most part, the practice of the Church of England
stayed the same.
Would not have been distinguishable to any outsider who didn't know the background to what had been the case of the Catholic Church.
Correct.
And so the English Reformation, the major figure that drives the English Reformation is Henry. So if you remove Henry by going back far enough that you change the descendant line, that's one of the long-term ripples of this particular fork in time.
Correct.
So let's look at more of the short-term ripples, though. How destructive was the War of Roses on England as a nation?
Well, not the best analogy, but think of it in terms, and I'll put it in an American context, think of it in terms of the American Civil War, because that's basically what it was. It is a civil war. You've got in a lot of instances, people who are related to each other that end up on opposite sides. So you've got brother fighting brother, cousin fighting cousin, son fighting father in multiple instances. So it really not only messed with the population because a lot of people died, it also messed with the psyche of England. And you see this in various television shows and reading various things. There was also this swing of people didn't know where they were in England, because specifically in this period of time, when you're dealing with Henry VI and his successor, Edward IV, who's a Yorkist, Henry VI is Lancastrian, you have these families that one day they're in power because they're on the Lancastrian side, and literally the next day they've lost everything because the Yorkists are in power now. So it really damaged the psyche, as well as just families, breaking up families, death.
Right. And just the stability.
Right.
You know, I think you and I were talking about this. I know we talked about this on a different episode. It's portrayed during, it's part of the episode. In fact, it was your favorite episode that was re-aired during our holiday break, where we both picked an episode to re-air. It was the Sinking White Egg Basket.
Yes.
As we were talking about the fact that what happened as a result of that, the anarchy period that happened after that, is are we going to be able to have market or not? Because
right.
do I have the right paperwork to actually have the market now? Because who's ruling?
Yeah, who signed this piece of paper that I have? Oh, the one who's not in power anymore.
Yeah, and we talked about, I think it's in Follett's Pillars of the Earth, you know, there's this cathedral being built, and it's like being built, not being built, being built, not being built, being built, not being built. And the reason that keeps going back and forth is there's this instability in who's in charge. Do I have the authority to do this? Are the funds and resources there to devote to this versus being devoted to something else? And, you know, we see this also, again, we maybe should entitle this episode, Let's Visit the Recurring Themes. But again, one of the recurring themes, particularly not just of English history, but all history, is the idea that it costs money to fight wars.
Correct.
And so if you're raising money for a conflict, internal or...
External.
That money is not being put, you know, those funds and those resources, the time, the energy, are not being put towards the things that are more constructive. They're being literally put to something that is...
Destructive
in its nature. And beyond that, as you pointed out, that doesn't even get into the relationships inside of families, if it's a civil war, or just the general loss of life. People do die in war. In this particular time, people also die from dysentery. I mean, it's, I'm reminded of Hobbes' quote about life being brutish and short. But still, even more so because of the background that's going on there.
Yeah, I'm going to mention another show, just because I have it in the back of my head. Another show that deals with this exact period of history is The White Queen. And The White Queen, not to chase this too far, but... Edward IV, who again becomes Henry VI's heir in the What Did, his wife was a Lancastrian who married Edward. And so there's this one scene that I have in my head of the family has pledged its support to Edward IV, and so they're wearing white roses, which is the symbol of the Yorkists, and somebody asked them, they're like, if I scratch that rose, am I going to find the red underneath it? Because you just went and dyed the rose white, to be like, we're with you now, we're with you, because you're in power, even though yesterday you weren't. So it just goes to show how kind of quickly it swings back and forth, and how you have to keep your mind about who's in power now. Okay, I know where we are.
Right. And so again, that alters the trajectory of any nation. And I think England during this period of time is just a good example of how that alters the trajectory for not just a decade, not just maybe a generation, but for multiple generations. Which is why ultimately when the Tudors do come to power and sort of cement themselves in power, that becomes important, because that allows them to start
over, essentially.
Yeah, and flexing their muscle as a nation, not internally. And then I think it also plays to, we're talking a lot about Henry VIII inside of a podcast episode that's about Henry V, but that is also one of the reasons Henry V is so driven
right.
to have a male heir.
Right.
It's not just because that's a natural thing that would be there for any monarch of his day. It was. Particularly in a nation that only recognized or the progenitor for the male, but it's because he looks back on recent history being not that far back, and sees the result of either not having an heir or having an heir that is
very young,
and the dangers of that.
Correct.
In fact, even during his own time, again, thinking through here, just again, something that was recent, which is also derived from, what's her name, Philippa?
Gregory.
Gregory's not, it's the what became the Spanish princess on Stars, relates to this fact of it's actually Henry's sister, who is Queen of Scotland, who has the problem of how does she, in a regency position, if she even is going to be regent, how does she continue to maintain on behalf of her
son?
Again, regencies just don't go...
They don't go well.
They don't tend to go
well. Most of the time.
So, that's the big picture. No War of the Roses. If you have no War of the Roses, you can argue there's no rise, ultimately, of a Tudor line, necessarily. And so we get down to that path we've talked about before. No Henry VIII, no Mary, no Elizabeth. Then, because no Elizabeth, no ultimately the invitation to James. We've been there, done that. See multiple episodes about where that's at. And I'm sure we'll come back around to it again. In the shorter term, again, Henry is a notable figure.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, he's almost mythologized in Shakespeare's writings on him. I guess, is it the famous speech that's immortalized that's applied to him? And the St. Crispin's Day speech is his, right?
Yep.
In Shakespeare's writing. So in the short term, the other benefit of Henry not dying so young is you've got a young, late 30-ish Henry, fresh off a win, married with a son, already secured.
Mm-hmm.
He might do other stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. So is it possible, I mean, do you have any thoughts, we didn't talk about this off podcast, Lex, do you have any thoughts about what might have happened, what Henry might have done during Henry V's life?
Well, I think as you mentioned, he's a warrior. We've already done a war in France, so I think there wouldn't be that far of a stretch to start doing conquests in other realms of the world, whether that's in Europe or it's looking towards the New World. We're a little bit before the kind of big age of exploration, but we're starting to get that way in the late 1400s. So I think if you have this stable, secure Henry V, who isn't dying in 1422, if he's living, I mean, he's only in his 30s, so if he's living into the 1460s, 1450s, I think you might see him start to dabble in New World exploration and things like that, and kind of expanding. He's already expanded his realm with becoming King of France in addition to the King of England, so I think you see him expanding his empire into further reaches of the world, for sure.
Yeah, one of the things that's always intrigued me, this is a little bit of a departure, but I think it relates to this, is eventually Columbus, an Italian, will sail on behalf of Spain in 1492 and quote-unquote discover the New World. But the Portuguese were also a major exploration influence. They had just chosen to be working around the coast of Africa and opening up the trade routes to, in fact, they sort of owned the sea trade routes to Asia, going around the African continent route, which is why there's this desire to see if we can go the other direction and get there quickly. You know, England is... and even then was well known for being a naval, militarily, but certainly a capable merchant nation. Much more so, England will become more of that moving forward. But it's always intrigued me the idea of if you had stability in England, given their sort of natural bend towards being a seafaring nation, being an island, all the reasons for that, would they have maybe started to challenge the Portuguese in the traditional trade that went around Africa? And so you may have seen a very different type of colonization map for Africa, where it would be more English, and then obviously ultimately once, you know, maybe an English, someone convinces an English sailor to try to sail west to get east. So maybe it's not a Columbus, maybe it's, you know, fill in common English surname here.
Right.
Might have been what would been there. So I think it's interesting to posit the idea, again, this goes back to that idea of stability, to posit that idea of if you had had a more stable England, not enduring the War of the Roses, having a more stable situation with its continental ally / enemy in the nature of France, what could have happened in terms of England becoming more of a exploring versus a capitalizing on exploration nation, which is ultimately what happened. They weren't the big explorers per se, but they capitalized on it.
Right.
Or perhaps them challenging the Portuguese or somebody else for some form of dominance in the trade around Africa and what that ultimately meant into the Indian Ocean.
Well, and I think, yes, we know Henry V as this warrior king. He was good in battle. But also, the only reason he becomes king of France is because of a thing called a treaty. So you might not have seen him challenging places like Portugal and Spain militarily, but you might have seen him allying with them in a treaty to, hey, Portugal, let's ally together. You've already got these trade routes. Let's work out an agreement. I don't want to fight you, but I want to ally with you and extend my influence that way. So we tend to think about Henry V as just this warrior king, and that's fair. He was good in battle, but if you have him living longer and he's able to use his diplomatic muscle, I think that's another possibility to kind of ally himself with the different countries of Europe to extend his influence that way as well.
Yeah. So the near-term influence, again, potentially is a stronger, more engaged, more international England. Not that they weren't during this period of time, because you couldn't avoid it, but powerful in a different way. We've talked about that, I think, also in a past episode. But then you also, of course, you avoid the War of the Roses, which creates longer stability there as well. One of the obvious downsides, because we've made like 5 references here to fictional novels or the television miniseries that have been made from them. A lot of mileage has been made out of Gregory's books, for example, in a lot of ways.
Which really only cover like 100 years, if you think about it.
Yeah, and she's managed to write, what, 5 or 6?
Something like that.
Or more novels. The thing that immediately jumps to mind is one of the impacts of Henry living longer is, you know, you may have different stuff on TV.
Yeah.
Because you wouldn't have this great sort of almost epic, the War of the Roses, all that represents, that is just good fodder for history, but it's good fodder for historical fiction.
Yep, I mean, we've talked about this, again, the theme comes up a lot, but the England we know as England would not exist in the same way because somebody didn't die at the age of 35.
Right, and so it does matter. Of course, it matters when that person that dies is the king, there's no doubt about that. But, you know, I just can't, you know, would you be as fascinated, would you be as much of an Anglophile if English history were sort of, whatever, you know. Yeah, and so-and-so had a son, and so-and-so had a son, and we get up to something like, you know, it's more like the Louis in France. You know, suddenly by the time of the early 17th century, you know, you're dealing with, you know, Henry the 11th, Henry the 12th, because there's been this nice long,
uninterrupted
stable line, you know, and you know, something else would have happened, because that's the nature of history, is that what did happen, what didn't happen, that's what we do here, the what ifs, but there would have been a different something that did happen,
right,
that probably would have been noteworthy or revolutionary. So, all right, anything else you can think of that's a big part, that's unique from maybe what we've talked about before, that's part of Henry V's surviving?
Not really. It's just Henry V is interesting to me because he's kind of the starting point of this whole thing, but he kind of doesn't really get talked about. People talk about his son, Henry VI, and obviously the War of the Roses and what happens after that. But the only reason all that stuff is allowed to happen is because Henry V... doesn't really get talked about that much, in my opinion.
Right. So he was very impactful in his life, obviously. Agincourt being a favorite, famous victory, the things that he did. But he actually has more influence by getting dysentery probably than he did by anything else.
Yeah. That's why he's famous. Not because of Agincourt. Because he died of dysentery.
Died of dysentery. All right. So that brings us to the end of today's episode. Just want to remind you again that we do have a place on the web you can go and visit us. That's at www.aforkintimepodcast.com. Lex, we haven't sort of touted this in a while, but one of the things that's also very important, we're having a lot more folks that are finding us by web searches and finding us by searches on the various podcast engines. And those include, those are the result of what happening on the various podcatchers.
That'd be, we got listed.
Yep, which means also that there's a chance to be rated and reviewed.
Correct.
And so one of the things we would urge you to do, we know it takes a little bit of extra time. We always realize when we mention these things sort of at the end of a podcast. Podcast is primarily a one-way audio thing, and we know that's what it is. But if you haven't had a chance to go to your podcatcher of choice and leave us a rating and or a review, we would really appreciate that. I've come to better understand in the last year and a half how that drives the search engines, not only there, but the search engines in general. I've mentioned this a couple of times, so those of you that are familiar with our webpage, I've posted this a couple of times. We have these, what I call outlier episodes. They're the episodes that, when you look at the statistics, get more listens faster and differently. One of those outlier episodes, I think, is also one of Alexis's favorites. Guess what it has to deal with? It's an episode called Protestant Wind, which was our first episode in the Hurricane History series back in June of 2020. I discovered why we noticed this one just basically, if you will, rocketing up the charts. You can see it as a real outlier when you looked at the number of listens, and it had the same number of listens in half the time as many other episodes. So why would this later episode catch up to former episodes? Well, part of that is we have a growing listening audience, and we know that. But part of the reason was the term Protestant Wind being in the title, and Google search engines on Protestant Wind. And so suddenly our little bitty niche podcast was on page 2 of a Google search when you looked up Protestant Wind, which is one of the terms that's used to describe the situation with the Armada. So your little rating and review can help people find the show. And one of the interesting things about people finding the show is that more and more people are finding the show and reaching out. And you'll see this over episodes that are in the coming weeks and in the coming year. They're reaching out in a way that they'll be participating with the show. So that's a long way of saying, do us the favor of, we prefer 5 stars, but just go and do it if you get a chance.
Yep.
And take care of it. Last thing we're going to do is, again, thank everybody for your support during 2020, a trying year, which we're not fully done with yet. The good news is there's vaccines now that are starting to become available for the global pandemic, and hopefully we'll see the impact of that quickly in 2021, although it will take time. But we appreciate the support of our listeners. And just would encourage you, if you do have the opportunity and you do have the means, we would appreciate the other ways that you can support the podcast. If you go to our website or look in the show notes, you'll find a link to our Patreon page, where if you want to become an ongoing supporter of the podcast, you can do that for as little as $5 a month. And that money gets put to good use. It helps to provide the storage space for the episodes and the hosting and all the things that go with the podcast, which are fairly nominal costs, but they are, in fact, costs. And then, for example, I'm looking here at the mixing board that we use now and the microphones that we use now. Those are the result of the kind support of our listeners that have been provided over the first 18 months of the podcast. And even if you can't do support on an ongoing basis on our website, you'll find a way that you can provide a one-time donation or one-time support. And if you want that to be designated towards something, let us know what that is, and we'll be happy to do that. So I don't have anything else. Lex, do you have anything as we get ready to close?
I don't think so.
All right. Once again, we thank you for joining us here on A Fork in Time, and we remind you of sort of, oh, I do have one more thing.
Okay.
If you do go to the website, one of the things that I was able to work on over the holiday period is merchandise.
What?
Yeah. Alexis doesn't even know about this because this is so new. So there's a couple of different companies that do this, but one of them actually makes it very... You know, part of the problem with doing customized logo merchandise is normally you have to do like setup charges and minimum orders to get things down to a reasonable price. And so there are a couple of resources online, including one that I became aware of because of one of the podcasts that I listen to, that will actually let you do that sort of on demand. So if you've been dying, I mean absolutely dying, you cannot believe that you do not have a Fork in Time coffee mug, for example, to drink your coffee out of. If you go to the website, you'll find the option there. It's one of the links that's at the top of the site. It talks about being able to shop for logoed gear. If you click there, you'll see that you do have the ability to order shirts and hoodies and t-shirts. At this point, it's just our basic logo, so it's nothing complex yet. we'll work on adding some specialty things there. For example, I think we will end up with a shirt that says, if you encounter a fork in time on the front, and on the back, it'll probably say,
I'd wear that shirt. Take it.
We'll get some stuff like that going, but taking a little bit of the advantage here. If you do that, a small and very nominal part of that ends up trickling its way down into the resources that help support the show. But it's a way to, a reason I mentioned that is it's not about the financial part of that. The couple of dollars for you buying a t-shirt is not a critical thing, but it does, if you're wearing that t-shirt, if you're so inclined to do so, or using that mug, somebody asks, well, what is this a fork in time thing? Aha! Now you have the ability to...
it's a conversation starter.
It's a conversation starter. So if you haven't had a chance to check that out, that's something new that's there. Also, I should mention for our patrons, our Patreon supporters, after a period of time there for ongoing supporters, there's some merchandise that we give as a thank you. So that's also something that we recognize. You work hard for your money when you choose to devote it in this direction. We hope it's because you enjoy and find the show valuable. But also want to give you something back in return. So again, apologize for not telling Alexis about that and surprising her. It was interesting to watch her face.
I went to the website. I have the website pulled up right now, guys.
Yeah, so just mentioning that stuff is there. And any feedback that you have on that, this is a new thing to us. I think the prices are reasonable, all things considered, but particularly because we don't have to pay the larger upfront charges to get things set up, which is one of the things that I'm most excited about. So if you've been craving some A Fork in Time merch, it's possible to get that now. That's the good news.
Perfect.
All right. So having said that, I mentioned it here as we were leading down towards the close. We like to sort of close out with our sort of take on that famous Yogi Berraism. And that's, if you encounter a fork in time, Lex, what is our recommendation?
Take it.
Thanks for joining us today, guys.
Thanks for listening to A Fork in Time, the Alternate History Podcast. Learn more about the podcast at www.aforkintimepodcast.com. Join us next time.